Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Okay, well, imagine a world without animals. No dogs, cats, lions, birds, lizards, fish, dolphins. What a loss. Of course, there'd also be no rats, wasps, jellyfish, or other dangerous animals either. There is both a beauty and a danger in the animal world. Now, why is that? Andrew Lindsay is a rare breed. He's one of the few theologians in the world to focus his work on animals. Why did God create animals? How should we treat them? Should we eat them? And will they get to heaven? All the big questions we'll ask about Andrew. He's the director of the Oxford Centre for Animal Ethics, author of numerous books, including Animal Theology and Why Animal Suffering Matters, and he's on the line now. Andrew, welcome to Open House.
Well, great to hear from you, and greetings from sunny Oxford.
Yes, sunny Oxford. I don't normally think of Oxford as sunny or anything in the UK as sunny.
No, I'm afraid it was a joke, really.
No.
Because it's invariably dark and dank, and it invariably rains in Oxford, as it is now, actually.
Oh, dear. Well, we'll try and brighten up your day with this conversation, maybe, give you an opportunity to get all of that wisdom out. Now, apart from you, C.S. Lewis, and maybe, I don't know, one or two others, maybe in the history of the world, there have been very few people to focus their work on animals. In fact, it's actually been said that you have coined the term animal theology. How did you come to focus your work in the whole area of animals?
Well, I think it began first as part of my studies. I began to see that, well, really, not many Christians especially had begun to think about animals. So I began to write in that area. That was, gosh, nearly 40 years ago, and since then all the invitations came because I was one of the very few working in the area, and sadly still am, though there are some up-and-coming scholars, I'm pleased to say.
Mm. It's strange, isn't it, that there have been so few who have kind of focused on this area, because we love our animals. In fact, there are times where we love our animals more than we love other human beings.
If only that was really the case. No, the situation is that the history of our treatment of animals is really a history of neglect and insensitivity. And I'm sorry to say that the Christian tradition in particular has always had a bit of a down on animals, you know, regarding them simply as tools or machines or things for us to do as we like with. So all in all, the history of our treatment of animals shows, how should we say, the more negative side of human nature. The situation is that in the UK, at least, the records of cruelty to domestic animals are now at an all-time high.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there is a kind of flip side, and the flip side is, well, we cherish and love the animals the particular companion animals we choose to live with. It's also true that we discard tens of thousands, actually, when we want to. So companion animal keeping is a rather mixed blessing from the animal's point of view.
Interesting. Okay. Let's start off with some foundations, and we can build on that. Give me kind of a general, basic, kind of biblical Christian approach to animals and why God created them. I mean, the fact is we could actually have a world without animals. So where do we start when it comes to a Christian approach to animals?
Well, the first thing we have to say is that animals, you know, whether they're worms or wasps, are fellow creatures. They're not some alien beings. They also emanate from the Creator's hand, and we are here to look after them and care for them, which is really what dominion means. And I think part of the problem is that so much of our thinking about animals has been anthropocentric. By that I mean human-centered. You know, we ask, well, why did God create the wasps, or why did God create snakes? But you see, from a theological point of view, we need to think Godward. We need to ask, well, why did God create such a world? And the answer is, I think that God didn't simply create the world for human beings. God, the Creator, has created millions, if not billions, of animals, and we should have regard for them precisely because God created them.
C.S. Lewis was the one who talked about that animals in some way, in their own kind of way, reflect something of the character or the nature of God. Would you concur with that?
Yes. I mean, without getting into complex theology, I mean, Christians worship a God that is a community of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, a diverse God, a complicated God. And therefore it follows that creation itself should in some way mirror that complexity that we believe is there with the very heart of God. I mean, the God who meets us in Jesus is the triune God who delights in diversity, delights in different kinds of being. Isn't, if you like to put it more provocatively, simply interested in the human species.
That is certainly provocative. I'm going to be interested to see the conversations we can...
So much of Christian theology has, I think, been corrupted by an anthropocentric kind of thinking that we're the only species. Although God creates millions of species, God is only really interested in one of them. Now, I don't think that's true for a moment. If you look at the beginning of the Bible in Genesis, you'll see that God creates all kinds of beings, blesses them, gives them their own right to live, their own living space, before human beings arrive on the scene.
And then, of course, where I think probably the focus comes there is because the animals and all the rest of the created world are created good. He says it's good. And then when humanity is made, it's called very good. And I guess maybe that's where the focus has come on humanity being the pinnacle of the creation.
Yes and no. I mean, if you look at the first saga in Genesis, the end of the saga is not the creation of human beings, but the Sabbath. God creates a world full of teeming with life, giving them their own life and destiny and space, and then creates human beings to care for them, which is what dominion means. Mm-hmm. And then they all rest on the Sabbath. And then God says it's very good. In other words, the point of creation is not the making of human beings, but Sabbath. And Sabbath means, well, the enjoyment of God forever.
Interesting. 1-300-40-20-20. I'd love to get a conversation happening about this. What do you think about what Andrew Lindsay is saying? He's an animal theologian and director of the Oxford Centre for Animal Ethics. Okay, Andrew, now, before we move off for this particular topic, is there not a difference, though, between, say, a cockroach and a dog, and then a dog and a human? I mean, there's got to be some degree of difference in terms of value, don't you think?
Yes and no. I mean, interestingly enough, in the Bible, the one human being, the one species that is capable, as it were, of degrading itself, of becoming worse than any other species, is the human species. You know, Genesis 6:6, God looks at all the violence in the world and says, I'm sorry that I made them. In other words, we are unique in our capacity for evil, for sinfulness, for wickedness, for violence. Of course, other creatures are violent, but they're not moral agents in the same way in which human beings are. And that, I think, is the really crucial difference. I mean, the difference between us and every other creature is that we are moral agents. We know the difference between right and wrong. In the words of Hazlitt, the philosopher, we're the only species that can laugh and cry because we're the only species that knows the difference between what is and what should be.
Mm-hmm. So that's where our uniqueness lies. Of course, because some people would say, well, if it's a situation where, you either save a human life or you save the life of a dog, for instance, then you go for the human life, of course, because there is greater uniqueness, greater value there. Would you agree with that in general or what?
I would put it a bit differently. I would say that we're special because we're made in the image of God. We're given dominion over animals, and we're made in the image of God. But that doesn't mean we can do what we like with animals. It means rather that we have a special care for them. Mm-hmm. The very image in which we're made is the image of a God who is loving, generous, holy, and therefore we can't treat animals in an unloving or unholy way.
Yes. Okay, get that. Now, do animals have a soul?
Actually, even Catholic tradition has never denied that animals have souls. It's denied that they have rational and therefore immortal souls. But for myself, I believe in the redemption of all creation. That's, I think, the most biblical doctrine when it comes to the afterlife. And indeed, for me, the issue is not whether animals are going to be saved or redeemed or in heaven. The question is whether human beings are. I mean, after all, human beings are these violent, sinful, wicked beings, or at least they're capable of being so, whereas animals are morally blameless. I think it's pretty certain that animals will be in heaven. The real question is whether we will be there.
Interesting. Now, morally blameless, animals being morally blameless, let's explore that a little bit. Anybody who, and I'm sorry to keep on going back to the puppy dog scenario, but I guess it's the one that we so easily think of. Anybody whose dog pees on their carpet certainly doesn't think that they're morally blameless. How are animals morally blameless, do you think?
Well, they're blameless in the sense that human beings made in the image of God are moral agents. They know the difference between right and wrong, and they can behave accordingly. I don't blame a lion for eating a gazelle because, well, lions have to eat other animals in order to live, whereas human beings have a choice. The poor dog who pees on the carpet has obviously suffered from a lack of appropriate behavioral training.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the human being that's at fault there. They should have opened the door and let it go out into the garden.
Okay, now let's put this into the context of the quote-unquote Christian worldview, the kind of broad narrative, the broad story of what the Bible says about the beginning of the world, the end of the world, and everything else. It says God created the world good, then came the fall. Humanity sinned, then suddenly there was sin in the world, and humans turned against humans, they turned against God, they turned against the animals, etc. Where do animals fit into the fall? Were they in some way influenced by that? And if so, how, particularly if they're not morally responsible agents?
Yes, well, I think that's one of the reasons why Christians should care about animals. You see, they are in some way involved in the fall, even though they're not responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
They are, as it were, well, they're the collateral victim of humans' descent into evil. In Genesis 1:29, after giving dominion, God gives human beings a vegetarian diet. Now, almost all Christians remember that we're made in the image of God and given dominion, but they always miss out verse, what is it, chapter 1, verse 29, we're given a diet that excludes meat.
Yes.
So, in other words, the Sabbath, the saga that leads up to the Sabbath is a peaceful kingdom, a peaceful creation. And then human beings fall into wickedness. And it seems to affect the whole created order. Now, that may not be literally true, but it certainly is how we experience creation today.
Mm.
It is violent in the sense that creatures, you know, live by eating one another, and human beings live by being violent to one another, or at least many of them do.
So do you think that there was no predation, no animals eating other animals before the fall of the world?
Well, I think you have to look at it a different way. I would say that the question is why the authors of Genesis envisaged a world that God created that was non-violent, even though they themselves were not vegetarians, they were not opposed to capital punishment, they were not opposed to war, they weren't pacifists. Why is it that they thought that holy, loving creator must have created a world without violence? And then I think you begin to see that there's something deep in the Jewish and Christian psyche about how violence is a departure from God's will, which is why, for example, in Isaiah 11, we have this notion of a future restoration of creation, the lion lying down with the lamb,
mm-hmm.
where there is actually no violence.
Mm. All right, love people's thoughts, 1-300-40-2020. This is Open House right across the nation. Andrew Lindsay is an animal theologian. We're talking about animals in, I guess, the Christian understanding of things. You know, where do they fit? Why did God make them? What's gone wrong with the world? And indeed, how should we treat them? We're going to get to that in just a second. Love your thoughts, though. 1-300-40-2020. That takes us naturally to this idea of heaven or the new creation. Again, that's the kind of third stage, really, of the Christian story. There was the good creation, then there came the fall where evil entered the world, and then there's going to be this new creation, the new heavens and the new earth that the Bible talks about so wonderfully in Isaiah and Revelation and other places. Now, you mentioned that passage in Isaiah where it talks about the lion lying down with the lamb. It is a striking image, isn't it? Because it does suggest that while at the moment lions and lambs eat other animals and everything to go and to survive, that one day it will not be so, that predation will actually end. So that does lead to specific animals in heaven. What about my, you know, favourite childhood dog, Scotty? What's the chance that he's going to make it into the new heavens and the new earth?
Well, I understand that sometimes even Christians are sceptical about this idea of of heaven being big enough to accommodate all the animals and indeed all the human beings that have lived on the earth. But you see, I don't think the issue is about space so much as divine love. You see, I don't think any creature that exists is created for oblivion. I mean, that may be the case in terms of some human beings, but for animals, God delights in these creatures and wouldn't create any being whose sole point of existence was simply to suffer and die. So I feel very confident that the love of God that brings these creatures into being will, as it were, electing them into an eternal kind of fellowship and relationship.
All right. Now, where will it end, though? Will it actually include the cockroaches, all the cockroaches of history, and all the, you know, the other, you know, the wasps, and all of those kind of what we might call, you know, the less friendly animals?
I can see you're really taken by aggressive or unfriendly animals. But you see, God hasn't created a world that is our pleasure garden. God has created a world for other creatures as well as humans.
Mm.
And it certainly means, therefore, that our heaven, what we regard as our heaven, will actually be a paradise for all creatures. I mean, for myself, the idea of living without meeting my own dog, Barney, that died, would be an insufferable idea.
Mm.
I, like Luther, who once said that his dog would be wagging his tail in heaven, so I believe that's true of all my companion animals and all the other ones too. I mean, the issue, you see, is about the love of God, not about the limitations of the human imagination.
Mm. Okay. Very interesting, Andrew. You got me thinking on a number of accounts here. If we suggest then that animals were, I guess, created by a God who loves them, and they are an expression of the love of God, expression of the diversity of God, that humans were given a particular charge to take care of them and express that love, etc., that God's given in the image of God to then animals and to actually have dominion, look after them, etc., that even there's going to be a place in the new heavens and the new earth for them as well. That leads us then to how we treat them now. Now, this has been a particular focus of your work, this whole area of animal ethics. And in fact, in your new book, Why Animal Suffering Matters, you talk about a number of controversial practices. What would be the essential problem, do you think, when it comes to our approach here? Does it go back to what you mentioned before, that we have said, well, we're the center of the earth, humans are the center of the earth, therefore we'll treat animals whichever way we want?
I do think we need a new kind of thinking about animals. You see, for me, I have to say it's gospel-based. I mean, I think when I teach ethics at Oxford, I always talk about a Jesus-shaped ethic.
Mm.
And by that, I mean, perhaps rather pompously, the paradigm of inclusive moral generosity. Now, what I mean by that is that a Jesus ethic favors the poor, the weak, the outcast, the lepers, the vulnerable, and so on. In other words, it privileges those that are vulnerable. Now, I believe if you take that model into one's own thinking, one is led to a different view than often the contemporary view is about those who are vulnerable or outcast. And I think one should also extend that, you see, to animals, because the whole point about mammals, at least, I don't know about wasps or worms, but certainly mammals, is that they can suffer. And the fact that they can experience pleasure and pain, especially pain, means, I think, that we have to revolutionize our treatment of them, actually. Indeed, I would say, controversially, that there is something Christ-like about the innocent suffering of animals.
Hmm.
Because animals are so innocent, that is, blameless and vulnerable, they cannot consent, and so on and so forth. So Christian hearts should really be moved by the sight of innocent animal suffering.
Let's touch on a couple of these specific areas that you raised in the latest book then, and give me a bit of an overview as to your thinking. Okay, hunting with dogs. Some farmers that might be listening will say, look, there's a place for hunting. We've got to keep the rodents down. We've got big challenges sometimes here in Australia with very large populations of just wild kangaroos and all sorts of things. So hunting with dogs, what's the problem?
Well, hunting with dogs in the UK is a kind of sport. I mean, after all, people don't eat foxes. I mean, this isn't for food. This isn't for some essential purpose. This is for fun. I mean, that's the heart of the moral objection in the UK to fox hunting, that it's for pleasure, for amusement. Mm. And I do think there's something very spiritually perverse about taking pleasure in suffering,
okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. I can imagine that with what I've seen on the telly of that kind of sport of hunting and then sitting the dogs after the foxes and things. What about some other forms of recreational, say fishing, for example, that's also a recreation. Is it okay if you eat the fish afterwards, or is it a problem if you don't, or what's your thinking on that?
Well, it's interesting. There is still a debate about whether fish suffer, but there is some evidence that they experience pain and fear. How far, we don't know exactly. But it used to be thought that fish were just, automata, but it now appears that they do experience some degree of pain. And I think we have to take that into account. I mean, I think it's very difficult to justify any activity that's just taken for the purposes of sport or pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see? I mean, wherever else we may disagree, I think here is a line that all Christians should agree on, that killing for pleasure is simply not compatible with the Christ-like life.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what about something as domestic as crushing a cockroach, that you find in your kitchen?
Well, we don't know whether cockroaches are sentient, whether they feel pain. There simply isn't the evidence that they are sentient and they feel pain. I think there's a big difference, you see, between those creatures, especially mammals, where we know that they suffer only to a greater or lesser degree than we do ourselves,
mm-hmm.
and other creatures. Mind you, I have to say, as a father of four, I've always taught my children to treat all the mini beasts, as we used to call them, the mini beasts, with respect. I mean, that's where my theology began. I would sit down and say, look, isn't that an interesting beetle? Isn't that an interesting worm? God made that, and in some way that contributes to the fullness of the world that he wanted to create. Isn't that interesting?
Mm, mm.
And I think we all need attitudes with a sense of awe and wonder, rather than the rather narrow view which says, this is in my way, I'm going to crush it.
Mm. Again, love people's thoughts, 1-300-40-2020. This is Open House. We're talking to animal theologian Andrew Lindsay about this whole notion of animal ethics. Love your thoughts on that. Okay, fur farming is another thing that you raise in the book. Tell me about that and where your thoughts go on that.
Well, I mean, there are all kinds of theological debates about meat eating and how we should treat animals, but it seems pretty clear that fur is not an essential item for human beings. But in fact, millions of animals are actually fur farmed. They're kept in small, barren cages and farmed for their fur, and then often are killed inhumanely.
Mm.
So I think fur farming is a particularly gratuitous example of how we abuse and exploit animals when we don't even need to. I mean, I don't know of anyone who has died because they haven't got a fur coat.
Mm.
Or there can be lots of disagreements. It seems to me that kill for pleasure and to kill simply for, adornment purposes, I mean, like fur. I mean, I suppose in Siberia there's somebody who needs the fur coat, but there are lots of other alternatives too. So, and we are talking here about a multi-million dollar business that consumes, what are the latest figures? I mean, they escape me immediately, but they are literally millions of animals worldwide that are killed for their fur. Now, that, I think, is very difficult to reconcile with a Christian vision of stewardship, of care for animals.
Mm. While we're talking about farms, there, of course, are puppy farms that are just kind of there to produce puppies and things like that.
Yeah.
There's been fairly documented evidence that some of these little dogs are being bred in horrendous situations. And I guess it comes again down to that issue of animal suffering and the cruelty that happens as a result of those commercial practices.
Yeah, I think fur farming is not about caring for the animals, but about caring for profit. I mean, it's tragic, really, because people go to a pet shop or see a puppy and think, oh, how wonderful, this animal will be as a companion. And yet, the truth is there is a history of suffering behind that sale, which people don't see. It happens behind closed doors. I mean, that's part of the whole problem, really, that we don't see the suffering. And therefore, what is out of mind is also out of our conscience.
While we're talking about puppy farms, then the pedigree dog breeds that have been found recently to have abnormalities because they've been kind of particularly interbred. The Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, which has got this, syringomyelia? Is that how you pronounce it? Where the skull is actually too small for the brain simply because of inbreeding?
Yeah. Well, again, this has nothing to do with true regard for the animals. It has everything to do with how human beings delight in certain characteristics of certain animals. A lot of selective breeding is actually detrimental to the welfare of animals. Indeed, we have in this country, in the UK, we have all this debate about dangerous dogs. Well, many of the dangerous dogs, the pit bulls, I mean, these were bred to be ferocious against other animals, especially in bullfighting, bull baiting and bear baiting in the UK. And therefore, they're unstable animals precisely because they have this history of being taught to be aggressive. So dangerous dogs, breeding dangerous dogs, has nothing to do with animal welfare or love of animals. They're actually a threat to human beings as well as a threat to themselves.
Mm. Now, what about testing on rats or dogs or any kind of animals when the benefit for humanity may actually be worth it? It might be a particular cure. It might be something to do with them. I mean, we're hearing about experiments on rats all the time. What about when those testings are actually for the benefit of humankind?
I think I have to draw the line at suffering. I don't think the Christ-like life that we should be trying to live is really ever compatible with deliberate infliction of suffering. You see, although it's true that we gain a lot from experiments on animals, the real moral question is whether they are ill-gotten gains. I mean, after all, experiments on human beings would render a great deal more beneficial knowledge. Indeed, the history of vivisection has included experimentation on prisoners of war, on black people, on children, as well as those who are mentally ill. So, I mean, my view is that utilitarian ends can justify the means kind of view really is not sufficient morally as a basis for justifying the infliction of suffering on animals. I realize lots of people will disagree with me there, but I suffering, it seems to me, is really part of the issue here.
Of course, some might counter that and say, well, if we don't, you know, improve the lot of humanity, humanity can't look after the lot of the animals.
Yeah. See, I think the specialness of human beings really consists in looking after the whole show, the whole garden, as in Genesis 2, the whole creation. I don't think it's right to constantly say that the animals should bear the cost, or the cost of whatever human progress there can be through animal experimentation. It's very, very difficult in Christian terms to justify the deliberate infliction of suffering on mammals, certainly at least. You know, the same logic that would justify experimentation on animals would also justify the experimentation on weaker human beings, as indeed C.S. Lewis pointed out many years ago. So I'm not a utilitarian. I don't think the ends justify the means. I think we should draw a line at suffering and the infliction of suffering.
Yeah, that is a very good point, that if we actually say, well, some suffering is okay for the benefit of humanity as a whole, well then, yes, where do you draw the line? Do we actually then inflict suffering on humans that are actually weaker for the benefit of humanity? And boy, haven't we actually seen that being used throughout history with diabolical, and I mean that in the true sense of the word, diabolical results. Okay, now let's end on this because I think it's a fascinating conclusion to our conversation, Andrew. You really champion the cause of vegetarianism. Now, we know that Jesus ate fish. We know that Jesus would have eaten lamb at the Passover festivals. Give me a Christian rationale for the vegan life.
I think it goes basically like this. We don't know everything about how Jesus lived and what he thought. But we do know that he favored the weak and the powerless. what I, as I said, I called the paradigm of inclusive moral generosity. And we do know that the heart of Christ's teaching was the notion of non-violence, not harming, no retaliation. So I believe anyone who's moving in the way of non-violence is moving towards a more Christ-like life. And I know in the past that Christians have said, oh, well, this only applies to other human beings. But I want to extend this a little bit to include our whole interaction with animals. When we can live less violently, then I believe we live a more authentically Christian life. Now, that doesn't mean to say that we can live without violence. I mean, in the sense that we can't even walk along the road without accidentally hurting or harming other creatures. But we can try to ensure that our fork isn't a weapon of violence, whenever we have the opportunity to do so, at least.
Okay. And what about, though, Acts chapter 10, when the Apostle Peter is given a vision that, you know, all animals are clean? I know there was a bit of a theological point being made there about, you know, Jews and Gentiles, but that others would actually point to various other passages in the New Testament, talks about, you know, some foods are okay for some people, they're not okay for other people, but it's okay, yeah. You know, love each other in grace. And again, Jesus eating fish and lamb and things. Could they nuance the view at all?
Well, I'm not sure, actually, that Jesus did eat lamb, I must be honest, because there is a difference of view within the Gospels, as you know, as to whether the Last Supper was a Passover lamb, whether it was a Passover, and there's no direct reference to a lamb. Nevertheless, I do accept it's possible it's that Jesus ate meat. I don't dislike it myself, but I think it's possible, and I see he certainly ate fish. But the kind of moral question one has to ask is, it may have been right for Jesus to do that in first century Palestine, but is it right now in the 21st century? I mean, in other words, he may well have eaten in order to live, in order to survive. But the truth is, we can now live and survive without killing. In other words, we have a kind of moral freedom that I accept that historically our forebears may not have had. Mm. You see, I mean, it's the biblical teaching on meat eating is rather nuanced. If you look at Genesis 1:29, as I said, you'll see that the ideal is vegetarianism. It's only after the fall and the flood that God allows meat-eating in Genesis 9.
Genesis 9, yeah.
So in other words, what appears to be ambiguous or confused, I think, is actually quite consistent. And it goes something like this. Vegetarianism is God's will, but yes, you may sometimes take life, but you must never do so except really under the pressure of necessity, you see. When it's really essential. Because there's a strange line, to get a bit more theological, in Genesis 9, where you must not even take the blood of an animal. Mm. Now, this is a very, very strange verse. Now, what does it mean? I think it means demythologize, something like this. Even if, as you take an animal, you must not, as it were, presume to take its life or be the owner of its life. That's what blood means, you know, life. Mm. So, Even though there are concessions in a violent world to eating meat, you must never think that this is somehow normal or what God really thinks is the ideal, as it were. It's not God's ideal for us.
Mm.
So what you see in the biblical material is, well, I accept it's ambivalent, but you do have a strong vegetarian motif that runs alongside even the view that eating for food is sometimes permissible.
Yes. Okay. Well, I think that's going to get us all talking quite a bit for the rest of the night. Andrew, I really thank you for your time. It's been completely fascinating to talk to you, and I think we can certainly agree the fact that, as you've said before, we have completely misused our God-given charge to take care and look after the creation, look after animals that have actually been given into our care to express the image of God to them through love. Thanks for your time again. Really appreciate it.
Well, I much appreciate your time too.
Andrew Lindsay there. He's the director of the Oxford Centre for Animal Ethics. What a fascinating conversation, hey? His latest book is called Why Animal Suffering Matters.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.